The following is a presentation of Second City Works, delivered by your earbuds at WGN Plus.
Welcome to the Second City Works Getting to Yes And. I'm Kelly Leonard, Executive Director of Insights and Improvisation at the world-famous Second City Theater. This podcast is about navigating work and life without a script. Improvisation is a practice in collaborating more effectively, tapping into your full creative potential, and building ensembles who can both support and challenge us. If you like what you hear, please rate us on iTunes and share the podcast through your social media channels. Help us extend the conversation. This is Getting to Yes And.
Working all day for a mean little man with a clip on tight and a rub on tan. He's got me running around the office like a dog around a track. But when I get back home, you're always there to rub my back. Hey.
My guest today on Getting to Yes And is Paul Zak. Paul is the founding director of the Center for Neuroeconomic Studies and professor of economics, psychology, and management at Claremont Graduate University. He led the team of scientists that first made the connection between oxytocin and trust, and his TED Talk on the topic has received over a million views. He has appeared on CNN, Fox Business, Dr. Phil, Good Morning America, and ABC World News Tonight. He's the author of The Moral Molecule and Moral Markets. His newest book is called Trust Factor, The Science of Creating High-Performance Companies. Paul Zak, welcome to the show.
Thanks so much, Kelly.
All right, so quick story. Some years ago, I had this really terrible idea for a Jewish-themed musical that we called Jewsical the Musical. And during the development...
I'm already in.
You would have lost a lot of money. We did. And during the development process, we held a staged reading at the Spertus Institute for Jewish Learning and Leadership. So in addition to the reading, we offered some improvisational workshops kind of on the side. And Hal Lewis, who ran Spertus and has a PhD in Jewish leadership, was observing us leading an exercise called Follow the Follower. So this is a silent exercise where one individual is secretly given leadership and the whole group has to walk around the space and the leader has to silently transfer leadership to another person who needs to silently take leadership. And that process repeats itself for a number of minutes with different people trading off leading this group. When we finish the exercise, Hal says to me, "You know you're doing Peter Drucker." And I said, "Who is Peter Drucker?" So suffice to say, I know who that is now, and his name comes up a lot in this book, Trust Factor.
It does. Peter had a huge influence on me, and I was honored to serve with him for 10 years on the faculty at Claremont. And so, yeah, I think what Peter did was he was a great observer of human nature, probably like you are, Kelly. Mm. And what I try to do is go to the underlying science behind that observation to see if we can derive some really specific insights to how to create organizations, teams that are super and gelled with each other, super effective, and perform at high levels.
I thought, yeah, and sort of the presupposition of the book, a quote says, managing people has been seen as an art, not a science. And I think what you're sort of saying, it's both, right? There's science underneath the way that human beings behave. And when human beings can be sort of intentional with knowledge and they can be more skillful and make the working experience better for everyone.
Exactly. And the hope, and I think I've delivered this in the book, is that the science provides non-intuitive insights that allow us to be better team members and team leaders. And that's what I really try to draw out from the experiments we've run, which is how do we really kind of get down to the deep, dark mechanisms and then reverse engineer that and go, well, if I really want people to work effectively as a team, what do I need to do?
And so this also begins with this connection between trust and oxytocin. So I think I need you to explain for our audience who might not even know what that is. What's the science around this, around trust?
All right. So oxytocin, as you said in your intro, is a chemical made in the brain that our lab was the first to develop a technology to measure in human beings the acute production of it. And in animals, it was known to facilitate birth and breastfeeding, in humans too, but also in animals, it allowed animals to kind of get together. So I'm a rodent, and I can't see you because I'm in a burrow, but I smell, like, oh, that's Kelly, he's awesome. My brain makes oxytocin, and it motivates me to affiliate with you.
Mm-hmm.
So we show the same thing in humans, in fact, that when someone intentionally trusts us, our brain makes this chemical, and it reduces the underlying stress we have about being around other people. Either strangers or people that we may know, which is appropriate. We're always maintaining this balance as social creatures between gaining the value of being around the other humans and being wary of those other humans if we don't know them that well.
And you write, too, trust begets trust. And I think what your examples in your book over and over again are, this doesn't, you know, it's not like sort of trust is in the company manual. High-performing organizations over and over and over again are sending out sort of trust signals.
And that's the key. I'm so glad you picked up on this, that it's got to be something that you constantly nurture and reinforce. Because our brain is a very lazy organ in a metabolic sense. It doesn't want to have to set up new pathways. And so if I'm in a high-trust organization and I experience that trust, I practice that trust all the time, then my brain defaults into being a trusting person. Again, if you come at me with a knife, I'm definitely going to behave differently. But what I'd like to do is, in these organizations we work with, create a culture of high trust in which people can really depend on each other, can trust each other, know the other people around them are reliable, and in that case, I can take a lot more risk. And now we're really into improvisation, which is your bailiwick.
Mm-hmm.
If I practice this, if I learn how to play off the other people, if I realize that they are my safety net, then I can take incredible risks and also have incredible wins.
Yeah. All right. And this really came to life in me, in your book for me about midway through, I think it was chapter 7, where you talk about caring. So I was like, I was literally on the phone, this was like 2 weeks ago, with the head of culture for Coca-Cola. And we have a mutual friend. And she was asking me what projects I was working on. Second City recently developed a program called Improvisation for Caregivers with a group called Caring Cross Generations. And we did this for the Cleveland Clinic, who will come up in your book quite a bit. And what this program does is use improvisational exercises and concepts like being part of an ensemble, about truly listening to the person across from you, sharing stories, all of those things to give more agency to individuals and have them recognize that they're not alone in the caregiving experience. It's not just them and it's not just the person they're caring with, but there are doctors and nurses and family members and neighbors and even other caregivers. And this group really gelled over this six-week program. And I was just blown away by how much science underlies how important caring is. And the woman from Coke got this, you know, not just in sort of the home, but in the workplace.
It is, and here's where the science really is useful. When we're busy, which we all are at work, our brain goes into kind of survival mode, and we start to filter out the things that aren't going to get us through the next 10 minutes. And one of the first things to go is listening, and you mentioned how important listening is. And there can be no more important gift in the time-constrained world in which we live to be fully present for someone, to actually listen to them, not to look at a device, to make eye contact, to give this person the gift of being fully present. And that's the beginning of building a caring relationship. And gosh, you know this. You can do this in 30 seconds.
Yeah.
You can be absolutely present, and it changes the entire way you interact with somebody.
Completely. And I think, I mean, it's never been more important for a few reasons. One, we're stuck in our devices, right? This amazing gift of technology we've been given actually can put us less in touch with other human beings. And as my friends at Caring Cross Generations always talk about fighting the robot narrative, that things are going to become more automated. And then what you're going to want from human beings is what essentially makes them human.
Right, which is that connection. And we see this when we run experiments, that in-person connection, much bigger bandwidth, bigger impact on the brain, bigger ability to influence that person that you're interacting with. Video conference, not as much. Text, not as much. And so we think about the ability of humans to be fully present. That's a bandwidth issue. And again, your brain wants to just idle as much as possible. So if I'm physically present and then also emotionally present, emotionally open to you, gosh, now I've actually got an opportunity to really build a connection and potentially move you or move us into a space which is very good for both of us.
Yeah. And you tell a story, and it is about the Cleveland Clinic, and I'd love you to tell our listeners about this idea around Code Lavender, which I think is built off of Code Blue.
It is. So Code Blue, as most people know in the hospitals, are an alarm that goes off when someone is in need of life-saving medicine, often a heart attack, but sometimes other medical disorders. So the person's dying, so we call it Code Blue. And yet individuals at work are often dying, and we don't have a way, I mean, dying emotionally.
Mm.
And they're dying in a way that is difficult to tell your coworkers, you know, I've just had two very rough weeks, and my mother just moved into Alzheimer's care, and my kid is sick. And I just don't have capacity to do the 120% like we all think we do all the time. And so, yeah, Code Lavender is this system that Cleveland Clinic developed and now other hospitals use that just allows you to put on a little lavender ribbon that just tells your coworkers very subtly, you know, I'm having a tough time today, and I could use a little extra care. And Cleveland Clinic, in their great depth of insight, also has access to counselors and to a massage therapist and to quiet rooms. And so if we really want people to perform at their best, we need to see individuals as full human beings with emotions, with personal lives. They're not a piece of human capital, as economists say. They're human beings, and that means that they're going to be inconsistent and flawed and beautiful and imperfect, and we should embrace all of that.
Yeah, this idea of acknowledging suffering at work. We talked to Jane Dutton, who's written about this, and it is it was really startling to me, especially having gone through that stuff, right? Losing parents, losing pets, and you kind of like you're walking out into the universe with this hurt, and there's really no way for anyone else to know the thing you've gone through. So I guess it harkens back to those mourning periods where people wear black and you kind of knew. It's almost like we need something like that, and this is an element of it, suffering cues.
Selfish approach if you run an organization, which is, we know the high performers are very rare. Why would you piss them off? Why would you put them in an environment where they can't flourish, not only professionally, but personally and spiritually? Create an environment where they can really flourish and they're going to want to stay with you forever. And that's what we want. I want the highest performers to be with me all the time. It doesn't mean if you're a high performer, you don't have a bad day. Of course you do. Even, this is a little private conversation between you and me, Kelly, but even you and I have bad days occasionally.
Mm-hmm.
We'll perform at our best. So why are we expecting perfection? Why can't we just let our emotions show? And when we do that, we build these caring connections. And now I get it. Now I get why I'm here and why you're here and why we somehow ended up in this organization. Try to, I don't know, move the needle a little bit.
You talk a bit about culture, and I like this quote, and I want you to sort of unpack it for us. You say, there is no optimal organizational culture, which might surprise people because they kind of everyone's like looking for that sort of nirvana culture, but that's not a real thing.
Right, because the organization changes, the people change, and so I think if you're looking for the optimum, this is a sort of the Six Sigma approach. Jack Welch was famous for implementing at GE. If you're looking for the optimum, you're just going to miss it. So why not just get better, right? I mean, it really is a very humble approach to managing the humans around you, which is, let's be clear on where we want to go. Let's, in my view, let's try to measure where we're at and set some goals, maybe audacious goals. Just get better over time, and that means really listening to all those smart humans around you, taking that information and doing something with it, and also understanding we're all imperfect.
I like that. You know, we have this thing at Second City where we have, you know, we started in 1959. We've never really closed except for like we had a fire a couple of years ago. And even then we were only down for a month. But you have the Second City Main Stage Ensemble. That is the group of performers who are on the stage now. And it's always existed. This ensemble has always existed, but different people come in and out at different points. But it's the ethics and the rules and the understandings around that ensemble that are the important thing. And every person who comes in makes it a little bit different. And I think that's kind of what you're talking about. And I remember we talked to a Reverend Sam Wells, who was very interested in the link between improvisation and ethics, because he felt like that is one way to actually teach ethics, is when you teach people how to sort of behave improvisationally, because it is all about, it's basically about being nice to each other and having good manners.
It basically is, and it feels like, gosh, we sure have learned this in first grade, right?
Right.
It's not that hard. Say please and thank you. Don't be an ass. Be grateful. So, you know, I start the book by saying, everyone in your organization is a volunteer, full stop. Right? They can choose to work somewhere else. They're not obligated to work for you. So why don't we treat them like volunteers? Why don't we treat them like the amazing human beings that they are and create an environment where they can flourish?
And this is when you talk about ovations, and it's a way to sort of encourage those people who work for you. And you say, quote, leadership is about developing the human potential around you. It is not an opportunity to threaten or intimidate others. So what are the best practices around ovations?
Right, and again, this is coming from the science side. So really, we want to set up tight feedback loops in the brain that encourage people to do their best and identify the risk takers and the high performers. So this ovation, this celebration of victory should be often. It should be done close in time to when that goal is met. I'm sure after every show you guys do at Second City, you have a celebration because, mm-hmm. holy crap, we survived another
yes.
night, right?
Exactly.
So in businesses, the same way, right? When you survive this difficult project, celebrate it, talk about it, debrief, see what we learned from it, how do we get better, but also make those celebrations personal. The person who led this team, recognize him or her, bring something to the table, something tangible, something personal. Let peers recognize individuals. Much better to have peers do recognition than the big boss, because the peers actually know on the ground what was happening that was so important. So that kind of recognition, so close in time, personal, tangible, unexpected, the brain loves that, coming from peers, has a bigger impact, and then you reinforce this culture that says, hey, what we really value are these high performers who can hit it out of the park. It doesn't happen every time. That's okay. Even as you know, an example in the book from many Silicon Valley firms, have monthly congratulations, you screwed up celebrations.
Yep.
So things go bad, let's celebrate that we tried. It went bad means we tried something new, we tried something hard. Cool. What didn't work? What should we not do again? And let's celebrate, shooting for the stars.
And when you're talking about feedback, right? I mean, we've heard this over and over from the experts and the academics that we have on, which is most feedback doesn't work. The annual performance review, right? So they're going to talk to you about everything you've done over the course of an entire year. Why doesn't that, from a science point of view, why does that not work?
Right. From your brain's perspective, it happened more than a couple of weeks ago. It's ancient history, and you've disconnected the effort for the performance from the feedback. So the performance has got to be as close in time as possible to when that goal was met or finished.
Mm-hmm.
And so then you set this tight feedback loop, which is what do we do? How well do we do it? What should we do better? And so I even mentioned Google used to have a 50-question debrief after every project, and they changed it to very much what the U.S. Army does and probably what you guys do, which is give me three things that went right, give me three things that went wrong, and then what can we do better? And do that immediately. Do it while it's fresh in your mind, and also share that information broadly. So it's really setting up these feedback loops that allow us to update our information in the brain, because if we don't do it immediately, it's not going to happen. So we know that. Anyone who studied a foreign language in high school or college and hasn't used it since then, that it degrades because you're not using it. So we've mm-hmm. got to use this information we have from the feedback we're getting. And being on stage is great feedback because you guys are getting second-by-second
yes.
feedback that
yes.
many employees don't get.
No, that's exactly where we draw it from. And what we also know is a director who's, watching you improvise on stage, and we're improvising towards creating content, so it's a sort of a process. The director will give you notes right after, generally with the whole group, unless they are very tough notes, like there was a problem, and then they'll take you into private to have that conversation, and you talk about that too.
Exactly right. So praise in public, critique in private, right? Critique in public. Yeah, your social shaming, that's
yeah.
not going to help anyone feel better or get better. It's going to make you angry and defensive. So, and no yelling, by the way. Let's not yell.
No yelling.
Again, that's a defensive mechanism if you're a screaming guy or gal. And otherwise, sit down and say, hey, but this didn't work very well. We all know it. If you don't know it, that's a mm-hmm. problem. We have to have a conversation. But, if you're getting any kind of feedback from an audience, from your peers, you're going to figure that out. So, look, this didn't work so well. Let's talk about how to make it better. That's a great conversation. And then finally, as you know from the book, if you have to let me go, I shouldn't be surprised about that. So my goal is whenever I fire people, they take me to lunch afterwards because I've worked with them. It just wasn't a good fit for whatever reason. And, let's help you get a different job. This one's not the right one for you. It's not helping the organization. I'm sure you guys at Second City have a lot of people come through who just don't make the cut for whatever reason.
Yeah.
Maybe the chemistry was wrong with the existing players. That happens in businesses all the time. Doesn't mean you're not a high performer or you couldn't have fit in, but we tried it for 3 months, just didn't work, so we got to make some changes for the good of the organization. But you're a great guy. We're going to help you get a job. It'll use my network. No problem.
Yeah, yeah. Turning those moments into celebrations is something that I was really, you know, struck by in the book. All right, I want to nerd out really quickly on one thing under here in this section, where you said individual performances tend to level off when teams get larger than 6 to 12. And I'm kind of curious where. So, you know, a Second City ensemble is 6 people.
Wow.
So that is what it has been from the beginning. When we'll do this, right? We'll add a 7th because we feel like something is missing and it never works. And while the 5-person ensemble has had to happen in the past, it is not optimum. 6 is our number.
Isn't that fascinating? I didn't know that, but
no.
What a nice reinforcement because, again, you run these experiments, right?
Yeah.
Sorry, using my language. You've tried 5, you've tried 6, tried 7, and 6 is the thing that works. Yeah, I think it's partly it's that magic number 3, right? 3 and 3,
yep.
Is really nice. You know, the size, you know, varies depending on the task the group is doing and some technical issues. But yeah, 6 is good. 6 is, you know, basically what Google does on Teams. And so yeah, keep it small, keep it tight. Then you can see everyone's contribution. You can give feedback in a reasonable way, and. Oh, that is fascinating. Well, that made my day.
Yeah, good. I when I saw it, my wife, who's worked at Second City forever as well, I'm like, it's in the book, 6 to 12.
And you were right.
And I get the 12 too. I could see how on a larger project, but you get beyond that, and it's no longer, that's not an ensemble or a team. It's a crowd.
Right.
I think. Okay. Another thing that was really interesting. So we talk and teach a lot about storytelling because we are storytellers, of people in the theater. And you talk about story doing and as it relates to a thing called purpose narratives. And I thought this was really interesting.
Yeah. So there are a number of story doing companies. I'm going to do that again one more time for the recording. There are a number of story doing companies. Tom Shoes is one of the most famous, and their 1-for-1 program. So you buy a pair of shoes, and they donate a pair of shoes to a needy child. It's really living your purpose. So purpose is why we even exist, right? So the sort of, you know, I'm guessing that for Second City, but, you know, entertainment's part of that. But there's a larger goal that you guys have, which is to open up possibilities for your audience and for your ensemble members. It's to launch them into a new career or a better career. But you have these really high goals. I'm just guessing. I'm making this up.
Yep. No, you're right.
Right. So every organization has that sense of purpose. And if it's just a saying on the wall and we don't live it, then it's not alive. So, again, I'm back to this lazy brain, which is not an analogy. Actually, your brain is very lazy because it takes so much energy to run. It just wants to cruise. So if our purpose is the thing that tells us why we exist, we need to live that purpose. And it turns out that story structure, that narrative arc, is really the effective way to make that story stick. So a narrative arc builds tension, and through that I sustain attention, but I also have some kind of conflict or a crisis or a human interaction that reveals emotion. And so when I have attention plus this emotional engagement, now the story makes sense to me. It's easier to recall, and I begin to internalize that story. So, just kind of running weird experiments, we happened across the power of story. So now if we put those two things together, power of story, lots of feedback on how well that story is doing, working as a group, playing off each other, learning how to, like an improvisational ensemble or a jazz group,
mm-hmm.
learning how to pick up the pace and carry each other through the goal line, now we have a rock and roll team.
We were talking about this very idea in, we have an innovation committee at Second City that I sit on, and I brought up the book, and we were talking about this idea because this is such a, and Second City is by far not perfect. I talk about this all the time. We're doctors who smoke. We talk about saying yes and then we get into meetings and we know. So, you know, this is not patting ourselves on the back. But the thing that we do have is this rich story arc that starts in the 20s and 30s where a woman named Viola Spolin, who was a social worker at Jane Addams Hull House, was hired to better assimilate immigrant children coming into her care. And that's when she created all these improv exercises and games so that the kids could come together and empathetically collaborate and communicate. The games were a lot of times in silence because the kids didn't always share language. And then her son, Paul Sills, was studying at University of Chicago, taught the games to his friends, Mike Nichols, Elaine May, among others. And they formed the first improvisational theater in America, the Compass Players, in 1955. That becomes the Second City in 1959. It's like, this is perfect. If you're talking about the elevator elevation of an art form and a purely American art form and what it was meant to do and what it morphed into, that is an incredible purpose narrative.
Yes, the founder's narrative. That's perfect. I would have put that in the book if I had known about this.
Okay. Well, yeah, next book. And the other thing you talk about too, and we do because we're very mistake oriented, because that's improv is filled with that the best learning is through small mistakes, and that without mistakes there is absolutely no innovation.
Absolutely, and we should encourage mistakes. If you're not making mistakes, you're not trying something new. So who wants the status quo? No business does. No organization does. So we have to get out of this mindset that mistakes are bad. So, you know, what we've done in hospitals is we have allowed frontline caregivers, nurses, nurses' aides, techs, to suggest ways to improve patient care, and you have to act on those, right? Not all those are going to be great, but empower them to say, hey, I saw this thing in these types of patients, or this particular patient really doesn't need this thing, or this procedure doesn't need to be done at 3 in the morning when they're asleep because they have sleep difficulties. So if you're a frontline person, that information needs to filter up to someone who can act on it. And now think how much you've empowered this frontline person to be part of the care team, to be part of the solution team, because there's deep frontline knowledge if you're that sort of customer-facing or patient-facing individual. It also requires a leadership change, which is all the knowledge is on the bottom. Mm-hmm. If it's on top, your job is to take in that knowledge and do something with it, make it better.
Yeah, and that's a big-time Drucker thing with the knowledge workers. Yeah. All right, so in a moment I'm going to ask you for your yes and story, but there's two things I want to talk to you about before we get to that. One, and I actually tweeted this out because I love this line, quote, one way for leaders to show respect for colleagues is to start and stop meetings on time.
Yes, I'm a big believer in that. It's respectful. Show up on time, end on time. If you need more than an hour, honestly, you're not organized. So break up into two meetings. Yeah, I think it's really important. And it's a sort of a level of integrity. If you want to live your life with integrity at work, outside of work, then start and stop on time. Yeah, I think it's very important.
No, over and over again, the ability to run an effective short meeting is so valuable and appreciated. I've just experienced that in my entire life. Here's the other thing that I thought was interesting. So the quote from the book is, leaders who have imperfections engender trust only if they are regarded as being competent. Incompetent leaders who ask for help from others undermine perceptions of reliability. And the reason I want to talk about this is there was a study not too long ago, I think it was professors at Wharton, around the use of comedy in the workplace. And what they found was when someone used comedy, they gained status. But if it was bad comedy or othering comedy, they were perceived still to have status, but they were perceived to be incompetent.
Right. So the goal of improv and what happens at work all the time is you need to pivot all the time.
Yeah.
And if you pivot to areas that you are not an expert, first of all, pretty much everyone already knows that if you're the boss. And so you can say, damn it, make this thing work. Or you can say, hey, you know what? Kelly, you're an expert in machine learning. Awesome. We'd love to do machine learning in our organization. Why don't you work on this? We'll give you a couple weeks, give me some feedback. So I've just empowered this person as opposed to disempower them. So really, a lot of this is about empowering everybody around you. And really, what more do we want when we're at work and we're at home, by the way, is to be empowered by those around us to really flourish and feel like we're making a big impact on the world. I can't think of anyone who wouldn't want that, even children.
Right. No, makes perfect sense. Okay. So we end these podcasts. Everyone gives us a yes and story. So the concept in improvisation is when groups of people come together to make something out of nothing, they can't accomplish that by saying no, and they can't stop at yes. They have to say yes and. They have to explore and heighten together. And I'm wondering if you could give us a yes and story from your life.
Oh, I've got 500 of them, but I'll give you an easy one. I got a call from the chief psychiatrist of the Superior Court of San Diego, California, who asked me why he has frequent flyers. In other words, he has the same criminals ending up in his criminal psychiatric clinic, and he said, you're some expert on decision-making. Tell me why we have the same people over and over. And we punish them, and it doesn't seem to do any good. And I said, thank you for your call. It's complicated, trauma, brain injury, blah, 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 and I'm very busy. Thanks for calling. And he said, yeah, but I want to fix these people. I want to get them out of the system. and I'm a psychiatrist. I went to Yale. I'm smart. I don't know how to do it.
Mm-hmm.
And could you help me? And I said, eh, you know, I'm very busy, blah, blah, blah. And then he said, would you like to spend a day in my criminal psychiatric clinic? And I said, oh, now that sounds interesting to me.
Mm-hmm.
That's something I got to see. And so I got sucked into working with criminals and subsequently spent a couple of weeks measuring oxytocin in criminal psychopaths in Wisconsin and really started thinking about using the technology we've developed and the insights we've developed to improve individuals' lives, but also to improve the way society works. There's a lot of impact to understand why brains, you know, kind of misfunction, why people are not able to integrate into society. So it opened up so many, many doors for me because, you know, I kind of followed this lead. So first of all, great come on, right? It's,
yep.
Hard to resist that. You want to spend a day in a criminal psychiatric clinic being patient.
So, and I'm curious, I'm actually curious about that too. Like, so were you witnessing then in that situation extreme behavior?
No, I was witnessing desperate behavior. In which people who were addicted to drugs or homeless or had been abused or were abusers were hoping for leniency, were hoping for any little lifeline. And some are hilarious. I mean, flashers, I mean, it's not funny to flash people in the street, but
right.
They have a real decision dysfunction, in my view, right? They somehow sort of think someone will be so impressed that they're going to have sex immediately, right? And that
right.
doesn't happen. So understanding that, like what's going on in that brain in which you are so desperate to, these are always men, you know, have sex with a woman or whatever you're trying to do, that you're really doing these extreme behaviors. So I think in science we focus so much on the average, and what that told me is let's focus more on the variation. People are weird in a such a beautiful and sometimes scary sense.
Yeah.
Where's that coming from? That's kind of awesome, right?
Yeah. Yeah, it's negotiating those edges because that's where the interesting stuff happens, but it's also can be a little bit dangerous. The book is called Trust Factor, The Science of Creating High-Performance Companies. Paul Zak, thanks for coming on the show.
Kelly, what a pleasure. I enjoyed it. Thank you so much.
Well, I've been working in a coal mine.